Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. When it comes to superlatives, it's hard to beat those that mark the career of retired NASA astronaut Peggy Whitson. She spent more time in space than any American astronaut, 665 days, and more than any other woman in the world. From her first mission into space, riding Shuttle Endeavour to the International Space Station, to her final mission, commanding the ISS in 2017, Whitson stands atop of the proverbial astronaut pyramid. Whitson has spent more than 60 hours of that time doing extravehicular activities or spacewalks, building and maintaining the International Space Station. Before her retirement from NASA in 2018, Whitson spent enough time in space to complete a hypothetical round trip to Mars and served in leadership positions as the chief of NASA's astronaut office from 2009 until she returned to flight status in 2012. Peggy Whitson's final stay on the ISS was also her second time commanding the space station, the first being a decade prior, and after handing it over to Russian Fyodor Yurchikhin in June of 2017, she finished her final stay on the ISS, accruing 289 consecutive days on board, the longest single spaceflight ever by a woman. She joined us recently to talk about her career and lessons we can all learn about living with isolation with our own crews at home. Peggy Whitson. So I'd like to go back in time to learn about your childhood to start off. Tell me about growing up on a farm in Iowa.
Well, the closest town had 32 people, Beaconsfield, and it, so very remote, rural, pretty much the definition of rural, I think. We had, you know, hogs and cattle, and my dad raised corn and soybeans as well. So I grew up with two brothers and a sister, and, you know, played sports when I was in high school, basketball and track. I liked science and studied a lot.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because almost everybody I've ever talked to on this program who is a scientist or an astronaut, there was something about the way they were brought up that brought out that curiosity about nature. When did you first really get interested in science in general and space in particular?
Well, space in particular is pretty easy. It was when Apollo 11 landed on the moon and I watched the first guys walk on the moon. I was 9 and I thought, wow, cool job. I think I would like to be an astronaut. Of course, you know, when you're 9, you want to be lots of things. And, you know, I, in school, I just enjoyed biology and chemistry and physics. And then when I got to college, I double majored in biology and chemistry, and then went ahead and got a PhD in biochemistry. It was actually very key for me, I think, that when I graduated high school, they selected the first female astronauts. And so I think my dream of being an astronaut became a goal at that point in time.
Yeah, because then it could seem real to you. I'm sure as a 9-year-old, you're probably not thinking about, you know, the culture of NASA being virtually all male, you know, during the 60s. And, you know, the idea of a female astronaut was not something, you know, most people thought of back then, but there were people who did and should have. But it's pretty cool that, you know, the first astronauts selected that were women right at the perfect time for you.
Yeah, it really does. I think there is something to that, things happening at important times in your life. And in speaking to young people today, I love speaking to 8, 9, 10-year-olds, because they are uninhibited about asking questions. They believe you when you tell them that they can be anything they want. I mean, it is a, and so I think that's part of why it resonated so much with me, is it became something very real, something very motivating in my life at that time. And yeah, I really enjoyed that age group because it's so much fun to chat with them.
There really is something special about being about that age, about 9, because I experienced the same thing, where you're old enough to kind of understand what's going on, but still young enough to, you know, not have to worry about the realities of, you know, of life and going through the teenage years of all of those changes, it's like the perfect time to fall in love with something that you're going to be passionate about the rest of your life.
Yeah, I think it was a key time.
And interestingly, recently, I think it was recently, at some point, you wrote a letter to your 9-year-old self. Could you tell us about that?
I think I remember at least parts of it. But the big thing I think I was trying to, convey to people was that you should believe in yourself, even if you're kind of like me, a little bit insecure, and believe in yourself and try new things. Don't be afraid to fail, because you will, but you're going to learn things. And by learning new things, you're going to be better at it the next time you try it, and then better the next time. I really think it's important, because I feel like I would have never been the commander on the space station. I never would have been the chief of the astronaut office. These were things that I did because they were a challenge. They were not easy for me to do. And so I try and encourage young people to challenge themselves, because that's when you're really going to find out what you can do.
Yeah. And before we leave that era, it's interesting to me. Do you know of any other astronauts? Because I've heard this story a bit before, that at that age, and when the Apollo moon landings were happening, there was like a generation of later space shuttle ISS astronauts that were, kind of like you, inspired by that, and it led them on that path. Have you heard that story before?
Oh yeah, many times. And it's not just astronauts, it's flight directors, it's flight controllers, it's, people of that era, I think, were really inspired by the space race and inspired by what they can do. What was interesting to me, being on three different astronaut selection boards, was hearing how other younger people were inspired by, surprisingly, Columbia and Challenger.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I, was kind of surprised about it. But I think what it did was it drew attention to the space program. And by that, they ended up being inspired to pursue a career with NASA. I did think it was interesting, though, because you wouldn't necessarily have thought that.
Okay, well, let's go forward in time. It took you a while to become an astronaut, about like a decade, as I recall. But you were, at the same time, you were working in within NASA. Tell us about your pre-astronaut career.
This is what I try and tell young people. Your path isn't always a straight line as you might want it to be. But along the way, you can learn some really interesting things. And that turned out to be really true for me. I ended up doing a lot of work with the Russians. I was in charge of a joint U.S.-Russian science program. Actually, it was joint U.S. and USSR when I first started. And then it became a joint U.S.-Russia program. And it was really another one of those challenging times where I had to, step up and do something I had no idea how to do. Nobody knew how to do. I was setting up a program in Russia, to train crews and negotiating for crew time and all these activities that I had no idea how to do. And I had to work with a very small team and, accomplish some pretty big things. And over those 10 years, I think I learned so much more about leadership and teamwork and international relations. And that's what actually ended up giving me the proper training to be the commander of the space station and to be the chief of the astronaut office.
A lot of us have seen recently that there's, been a call for new astronauts, and, there's a lot of people that I've noticed on Twitter putting in their applications, and they're all amazing people, but only a few will get selected. Can you tell us a bit about what that process was like for you how many times you applied and what it was like, you know, to not get selected. Because a lot of the Apollo astronauts that, you know, actually went on moon missions were not selected right away either.
Yes. And for me, I applied over the 10 years and they were having selections about every 2 years during that time. So I was, you know, applied and rejected 4 times before I got a call for an interview on the 10th year to be selected. It's a very rigorous physical and mental evaluation of, you know, who you are, what makes you up, and to try and better understand you and whether or not you'll fit in the astronaut corps. Because I think I saw a tweet earlier today that said 12,000 applicants had applied this year.
And how many positions?
Oh, probably between 6 and 12 would be my guess.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, you know, high odds against you. And of those 12,000, there'll probably be, you know, at least 10 or 15% that don't actually meet the minimum requirements of the education or work experience, et cetera. And so, but there's still going to be thousands of people applying for each position. And so it is very, very competitive, but the thing that is hardest for the selection board to pick out is not only, you know, you have plenty of really, really extremely talented people that apply, but you have to find the ones that will be the best ones to be astronauts. Who would I want to fly with for, you know, a year or whatever? Who's the one that would be the easiest to get along with, or who could lead a team effectively, or who knows how to really, you know, get the most out of a team? These are all things that you try and pull out of people during the interview process to find out who they are and how they might fit in.
Yeah, and that can't be easy. Can you take us back to the moment when you got, was it a phone call or an email? When did you first find out that I've been selected, I'm an astronaut candidate?
So they notify everyone on what day they're going to make the call. And they try and notify everyone on that same day. So everybody gets the news, good or bad, on the same day. And it was funny because I heard a rumor that the chief of the flight crew operations would be the ones that were calling the yes people. And I worked at NASA, so I heard the rumor. And then I had heard the rumor that the people who were getting the no calls would be, you know, the chief of the astronaut office. And I had worked with the chief of the astronaut office while I was in Russia some. And
who was that?
Bob Cabana. And when I took the phone call, I recognized Bob's voice and I was so disappointed. I was like, oh man. And he's trying to make small talk. And I'm like, just tell me, get it over with.
Oh,
and he
funny.
Asked if I would like to come and work for it. I'm like, yes.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, that must have taken you for a ride.
It did.
And then after that, you go into being an astronaut candidate. Tell us, you know, because they don't just say, you know, you're an astronaut and you get to fly on the space shuttle in 2 months. Tell us about the process before you get to your first flight. Let's see, I'm thinking your first year as a selectee was what, 2000? No, what was your first year? 96.
1996, right? Yes. And the basic training is about a year and a half long. You know, it was a lot of stuff, learning all kinds of stuff. As a biochemist, I knew a lot about some of, you know, the life support systems, all kind of made sense, and learning that wasn't too hard. Learning orbital mechanics, on the other hand, was pretty tough. But we learned everything about the comm systems, the power systems, you know, everything. So, but we had to learn it about the shuttle and the space station. And the space station wasn't even built. And we had to train on, you know, what it was supposed to be like. it was pretty overwhelming. There's tons and tons you had to learn. Probably the hardest thing I had to learn was the Russian language, because they anticipated we'd be flying on the International Space Station. So we had to take Russian language training as well. So everything was very challenging in that year and a half or so. And then we were assigned technical jobs after that. And we continued our training, of course, but we also had job assignments. So the astronauts spend most of our time on the ground, and the job assignments you get typically either support crew members that are either on orbit or training to go to orbit. So you might have different kinds of jobs. Well, I ended up getting a job where I was working in Russia because of my previous experience. I was selected to fly in 1999 on my first flight, and it was kind of unusual. The chief of the office at that time, Charlie Precourt, had talked to me about getting a shuttle flight, and which I was excited about. But I told him, you know, sooner I get to station, the better. And then a couple weeks later, he called and said, how would you like to be the backup for Expedition 3 and fly on Expedition 5? And I'm like, yeah, fantastic. And I was the first at the time to fly as a rookie on a long duration flight. And, wow. But because I had worked with the Russians so much, people thought it would be, you know, a reasonable risk to send me up. And I'm not the only one that's done it since then. Obviously, we send up guys, rookies, all the time.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with retired astronaut Peggy Whitson. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with retired NASA astronaut Peggy Whitson. She holds many records for time in space and spacewalks, ranking number 8 for total time spent living off Earth. Let's talk about your first flight, which was Expedition 5, 2002, I believe. So like 6 years later, about that, you know, since you've been training all this time, and you get to ride on Endeavour, one of the space shuttles. Tell us about that first experience of liftoff. What was that like?
Well, it's pretty amazing. The experience itself, as you might imagine, being on top of a rocket. I was so excited to finally be able to go after all these years of, you know, trying and training and everything. It was just exhilarating even to be on the launch pad with a vehicle I knew was going into space. But once inside the vehicle, you're laying on your back because the vehicle's vertical. And it's like you're laying in the chair with your knees up, and the back of the chair is lying on the floor. And so it's not very comfortable, and you have to sit there for a couple hours. But when when the countdown really gets close and you know you're going to go somewhere, that's when it gets pretty exciting. And 6 seconds before the launch, the main engines, the three liquid-fueled engines on the shuttle, ignite, and you can hear them and feel the vibrations, of course, of those engines as they come up to full power. And they come up to full power at zero, and if everything is going right, and then the solid rocket boosters ignite, and there is no question you're not going somewhere at that point, because the vibrations are really, really strong at that point. It lifts over 4 million pounds worth of hardware into space, and you get to go for a pretty fantastic ride. What's amazing to me is that it only takes 8.5 minutes to get to space, you know, to low Earth orbit.
Can you describe for us the moment where you first experienced weightlessness?
Yeah. So when we got to orbit, the first thing, the main engines shut off, and immediately your arms are floating. And of course, you're harnessed into the seat, but your arms and your legs are floating because you're in weightlessness. And I had a job to do. As soon as I got to orbit, I was supposed to get out of my seat and go up to the flight deck to take pictures of the external tank, video of the external tank as it floated away. And so I, you know, was unstrapping. And of course, I had a plan. You had to have a plan. So I was taking off my gloves, and Larry was holding them for me because he sat in the chair next to me, the seat next to me, and then the helmet, and because otherwise they'd float away. Then I was actually really floating, and it was exhilarating. I had always worried that I might get sick. You know, some people get motion sickness going into space, and it was quite the experience. I just felt, wow, this is so freeing. But of course, I, you know, had a task, so I was in a hurry, and I had to float up to the flight deck and get a camera for the other guy that was taking pictures, and I got the video camera out to take a picture of the external, or video of the external tank. And you get to the window, and it's unbelievable how beautiful that first view of the Earth was. It actually, the planet almost glows, you know, this blue and white of everything. And it's an incredible kind of clarity that you can see from there of our planet. So it's just very powerful, impactful.
And then you've spent more time doing spacewalking than most astronauts. I think you've 60 plus hours of extravehicular activity, spacewalks, you know, constructing this space station and doing various maintenance activities. Can you tell us about what the difference is when you're outside in that, you know, cocoon of a spacesuit, what that experience is like compared to, you know, that first view out the window of the space shuttle?
Well, it just gets better and better is how I like to describe it. It's the closest analogy I can come to is that I lived my whole life in a semi-dark room, and somebody turned the lights on, and that's when I got to orbit. Somebody turned the lights on, and then to go do a spacewalk, that's when I walked out on a bright, sunny street. It's that much different in how it feels, that of what you think, you know, how it feels, how you can see the clarity, the richness of everything is just that much more enhanced by getting the privilege to go outside in what's essentially a spaceship built for one. So it's pretty amazing.
And in all those spacewalks, did you ever have a moment like Chris Hadfield had or something like that, where you had a problem where his eyes started tearing up and it was very difficult for him to see? Did you ever have a problem where you were facing real difficulties on a spacewalk?
We had one spacewalk. I was with D'Antoni. We were repairing a bearing motor roll ring module, taking out a new one and replacing the one that had failed. And it was an unplanned spacewalk, and very complex and required a lot of interactions between the ground and us. And we lost comm with the ground. And normally when you lose comm, you would just quit the EVA, but we had comm with the station. And we had, and that turned out the ground could hear us, but we couldn't hear them. And so, you know, we were kind of struggling with how are we going to do this? Are we going to do this? And that whole process of getting that EVA done was pretty challenging. Another example on my last mission was with Shane Kimbrough, and we lost a shield when we were installing shields and That was another instance where, you know, the ground team had to come up with a very elaborate plan to come up with a workaround. And so those were, you know, some challenging times, but nothing where I was personally physically in danger.
Yeah. Did you ever have a moment kind of like Rusty Schweiker did on Apollo 9 where you just had some, because usually you're so busy on these spacewalks, you've got tasks to do. You don't just go outside for fun. But did you ever have a few moments where there was really nothing for you to do and you could just have some time to take it all in and have an experience like that?
Yeah, there've been times like that, and it is amazing to have that opportunity to do that. But I think one of the most telling times for me, it was, I think, on my second spacewalk. It was first one during Expedition 16 when I was commander and was changing out a baseband signal processor. And when I pulled the box out, the back of the thermal protection where the box had been was this bright, shiny, mirror-like substance. And in there, I could see me in a spacesuit and the Earth behind me and solar rays. And it was just like, wow, I'm really an astronaut.
Wow, it's kind of like a real selfie.
Yeah. It was just, I was like so taken aback by it. I'm like, wow, I'm really here.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, well, I want to shift gears quite a bit and talk about now, because we're all dealing in the United States and around the world with the COVID-19 outbreak, and all of us are trying to do our best, or should be, to stay at home and stay isolated. And, you know, for people like yourself and astronauts who've lived on the ISS for months and months at a time, you know what that's like, to just, you have to stay in one place. You don't just get to go wherever you want to go whenever you want. You can't just say, hey, let's go out to dinner. You don't get to do that. I'd like to start by asking you, you know, when did you start getting contacts from the media to ask you about this topic? When was the first one where people wanted to know, hey, can you give us your perspective?
I think Ann and I, Ann McLean, who's in the astronaut office now, was tweeting out some of the training program that I had kind of taught her class that we did called Expeditionary Crew Skills. And it's basically, you know, kind of how to get along with folks, and, you know, what this is what it takes to live or survive an expedition. And the interactions, the personal interactions part of it. And immediately after we did that, then I started getting interview requests. And
do you notice any parallels for yourself now, you know, because you can go outside, but you are, you know, do have to stay home. Are you drawing yourself on any of the lessons you learned, you know, as an astronaut over those many years? And what are some of those lessons you could share with us?
Sure. I would say sure. On some level, that's true. This feels different in some ways. For me, the way that I stayed motivated and positive throughout a long expedition, which not everybody does, you know, it gets to people, some more than others. But for me, was that keeping the big picture in mind, remembering the mission, the objectives on the mission, you know, my ability to contribute to the mission might mean that I have to fix a broken toilet or clean the vents again. But that's okay, because I kept the bigger picture mission in mind. And I like to tell people, you know, the bigger picture mission that we have right now is to try and keep as many people alive as possible, to dampen this curve. And that's why we're doing what we're doing. Because that, to me, gives me the motivation to say, well, of course, this is worth it. You know, it might seem like it's a pain in the backside, but it's of course worth it, because we're going to save lives. And, you know, the more the better. That's the big picture motivation. I think, you know, it's also important to have you know, maybe smaller level motivations. And I try and tell people find things that, you know, you always say you don't have time for, and, you know, whether it's write poetry or read a book or whatever it is that you feel you don't have time to do, and you want to, you know, explore something new, do those things. Try it out now. Find out what those things are, and give yourself some objectives, something new to learn, or give yourself projects. You know, I've been wanting to get that closet clean forever. It's going to get done today. And, you know, give yourself a timeline and, you know, some objectives, and keep yourself motivated that way if you don't have enough. I mean, most people are working from home, so you have those motivations as well. But, you know, it's important to make sure that your whole team is getting along and communicating effectively, because you interact with the same people all the time in your quarantine if you have people around you. And those communication skills are critical. And that's actually part of the expeditionary skills that we trained on, was effective communication, making sure that you're communicating your intent, and that you're asking questions back and forth, whether you're the recipient or the person that, you know, made the suggestion, to make sure that everybody understands where you're coming from and why. And I was talking to the kids today at a school, telling them, you know, everybody's got to have their job. And another great part about expeditionary skills is followership. You know, not everybody can be in charge of everything, but you can pick those tasks that, you know, you're going to take responsibility for as a follower, and say, hey, I'm going to be the one that does the dishes all the time, or I'm going to make sure the garbage gets taken out, or whatever. Pick your tasks, you know, and take the responsibility to be a good team member as well.
Yeah. And on the space station, you know, as in life, really, you know, you don't really get to pick your family. They are your family. You don't necessarily, you know, especially, you know, if you're a child or you're growing up in a family, you didn't pick these people. You were born into them. And it's the same thing as an astronaut. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the dynamics that went on some of your missions with dealing with different people and personalities and different cultures?
Yes. So it is important, all those aspects, and being able to communicate effectively, and in the case of different cultures, respect other cultures and ask questions and learn about their cultures. You know, that was, you know, one of the ways to, we would many times talk about, okay, in our culture, you know, after dinner, we would do this, or in my family, this is how we would spend our time. You know, on the weekends, and just talking and learning about what other cultures do was very enlightening, to understand not only the people that we were working with on board, but also we have all our communication with the ground control teams all over the world, and being able to understand their intent, and we don't get to see their faces even. So we're just listening to them over the comm loops, trying to understand what they want and how to ask questions in a way that's respectful in every culture, and get the information you need so that you can get the job done in the way they'd like it done. But there's always, you know, there's always potential for, you know, conflict. And one of the things we try and talk about is how to deal with conflict, and teach our crew members, you know, how to take on those issues, because a lot of us try and avoid them. And, you know, when people are getting on your nerves, sometimes it's easier just to, you know, go to your
room, the other room,
and shut the door. Yeah. And after a while, that can get old, and it can grate on people, and it'll be detrimental for the team. And so it's important to be able to communicate effectively, about how things make you feel when somebody's doing something that you find irritating, and how to present that as, you know, hey, this makes me feel uncomfortable when you do this. Can you explain, maybe, so that I can better understand why you're doing it that way, or whatever. to address a problem rather than just trying to bury it. Because, you know, if we're doing this for another month or two or three, we need to be able to communicate those things, because it's going to get old.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with astronaut Peggy Whitson. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our interview with retired NASA astronaut Peggy Whitson. She spent more time in space than any other American astronaut, 665 days in all, long enough for a hypothetical round trip to Mars. She commanded the space station twice, and just like Captain Kirk, she was born on a farm in Iowa. The question I get asked the most is, how long is this going to last? And, you know, I have to answer honestly that I don't know. You know, it depends on how we all react to it partially, you know, how we do with our social distancing and people doing, being good team members in society. If we do the right things, then it lasts less long. But if people go their own way and do their own thing and think it's okay to go hang out with your friends, then this lasts longer. The reason I ask you mention this is you've been a chief of the astronaut corps and you've been a commander of the International Space Station. You know, for parents, mom and dad, you know, they are the commanders of their spaceship home. Some advice that maybe you could give them?
Well, I think it's really good for everybody to feel responsible for different things. All the team members have to feel they're contributing. It gives them purpose. And, you know, maybe having your team members pick those tasks, say, hey, you know, we got to work together as a team. We got these things, you know, we don't normally have to do this much because we're not here all day, every day, eating three meals a day here. So we're going to need help doing these, you know, six different tasks. How do you think we should divide it up, you know, and work with the group to figure out the best way and give people ownership and responsibilities and make them embrace them as contributing to the team. That way, I think, it's more effective than saying you're doing task A, you're doing task B, you're doing task C, because everybody's going to hate that.
Yeah. Well, sure. Nobody wants to be just told what to do.
Exactly. So say, hey, look, we got all these tasks. They got to get done. How, you know, what's your ideas on how we can divide them up? How do you think would be most effective? Should we rotate it? Should we, you know, talk to them about it and let them weigh in. Let them present their ideas as well. They might have some good ones. Yeah. And, you know, come up with solutions that everybody can be happy with. Because it might last a while. On my last mission, the day before I launched, they came to me and said, you know, you might be staying longer, another 3.5 months, rather than just 6 months. It'll be 9.
That's quite a while.
And so I was like, okay. And so I talked to my husband. I said, we have to have a flexible plan to happiness. And our flexible plan to happiness means that, you know, if I come home in 6 months, we're going to be happy that I'm home in 6 months. And if I come home in 9.5 months, we're going to be happy that I come home in 9.5 months, because, you know, it'll mean I get to contribute to the space program a little bit longer up there. But it was something that I knew that I had to be prepared for from the get-go, and that he had to be prepared for from the get-go. Our expectations had to line up. And what we face now with the COVID-19 crisis is we don't know exactly when that's going to be. So that's where I'm like, we're going to work on this flexible plan where we don't know the exact end date, but that we know it's going to be longer than any of us wants necessarily. That was not the case for me. I wanted the longer mission when I was going to space, but for down here, we want to get life back to normal as quickly as we can. We just are going to have to deal with the fact that there's some unknowns out there. So our plan for happiness is going to have to be flexible, and we actually have to be happy along the way.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you about something that I think a lot of people may or may not understand about astronauts and their training. Is you know, I've gone through this myself, is you go through the day and you get into a task, you're working in the garden or mowing the lawn or cleaning the toilets or whatever you're doing, and you're busy and you're not really thinking about it. And then, you know, you wake up in the morning and it's like, and then all of a sudden it comes to you, oh yeah, we're in the middle of this terrible crisis that, you know, I have, you know, gotten out of my mind for a while. And then that fear kind of can wash over you. Can you talk a bit about, you know, because it's the unknown that really makes us more anxious and gives us anxiety and fear. I think there's a misunderstanding that astronauts feel no fear, that you're just all, you know, completely brave. You have to have some sense of fear when you are, and how to conquer it when you do what you did. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, I think your assessment of risk, you understand the risks. So we understand our risk now of, you know, the risk of getting COVID or transmitting COVID to people who might not be able to withstand it. So, you know, we understand those risks. We may not have concrete numbers on them. I mean, you know, even in the space program, we have concrete numbers we put on them, but it still doesn't necessarily, you know, saying, you know, you have 1 in 180 chance of dying going to the space station doesn't have the same, you know, nobody can tell you for sure, you know, maybe your chances are really a little bit higher, a little bit lower given different pieces of hardware, et cetera. So we're kind of in a similar situation here with COVID. We don't know the exact number to put on the risks and the exact benefits of what we're doing, but we do know we're going to be saving lives. And understanding what the risks are, understanding what we can do by hand washing, the social distancing, et cetera, to minimize our own risk and other people's risk, you know, potentially from us if we happen to be, you know, a person that was carrying it without demonstrating symptoms, you know, we can, you know, act on those risks and do things to minimize and protect ourselves. I don't think we should be living in fear of this. I think we should be, you know, being smart about what we're doing and minimizing our risk, because there's never no risk. Even before COVID, there was people dying in car accidents. I mean, there's so many risks in life, and I don't mean to make this risk with COVID-19 as anything at all trivial, but there are always risks in life, and I don't think it's healthy, you know, to be overly fearful. I think it's better to be smart and understand risks and do those things that you know will reduce your risk.
Yeah, like you mentioned in a car accident. Well, you know, you wear your seatbelt, you drive safely and defensively, you try to minimize risk. And the same thing with, you know, if you are keeping your house clean and, you know, making sure you're not touching your face and washing your hands and doing all those smart things, you are minimizing risk. You are doing something to make things better. You give yourself much higher survival chances.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I'd like to shift gears here and talk again about the space program as we go into the future. What are your thoughts on where NASA is now? And, you know, as we look back 50 years ago, we were exploring the moon in Project Apollo. We're right in the middle of the 50-year anniversary of the exploration of the moon from 1968 to 1972. What are your thoughts on where we are now and Project Artemis?
Well, I think it's a great project. I really definitely have, you know, am a strong believer that we need to go to the moon to effectively test our systems and techniques that we want to take to Mars. It's hard to wrap your head around kind of the distances we're talking in terms of space travel just to get to Mars. And whereas it's like 4 days to get to the moon, it might take us, you know, 7 or 8 months, maybe 9 months to get to Mars, just to get there. And then, you know, you either stay 1 month and come back, or you stay for full year, because you have to wait for the orbital mechanics to line up again. And those kinds of concepts make you realize that we need to be good at what we're going to do when we send people there to Mars. And I think we can test a lot of stuff on the lunar surface, plus also potentially build up the infrastructure that would allow us to have a continuous expansion of space by, you know, making fuel depots there, for instance, isolating hydrogen and oxygen from the water located there, and have fuel way stations on our other trips. And I just really see the moon as being the perfect test ground. I don't want us to do the moon and not do Mars. But I want us to build a sustainable structure that will allow us to continue exploration.
Yeah, and if there's maybe one lesson to learn from Project Apollo is that, you know, it wasn't really a sustainable program. It was designed to accomplish a goal, and then that was over. And now it's time to start doing things in a more sustainable way, like you mentioned. So what advice do you give for the young astronauts that you're starting to talk to that are going to be part of this? What's some of the best tips you give them?
Well, I think the future programs, because they're going to take, you know, worldwide efforts. They're going to be international. I think they're also going to have to be conglomeration of private contractors and companies combining and joining with government agencies, changing some of the regulations on how government agencies can hand out their money so we can make things happen a little faster. All of these things, I think, are going to be a conglomeration of change in how we do business that will lead us to the subsequent steps of space exploration. Because what we're doing is going to need to be a worldwide task.
And then finally, before we let you go, you know, there's always people that wonder, well, you know, why are we doing that? You know, we have enough things going on here on Earth. Why go to Mars? Why go to the moon? As President Kennedy once famously asked and answered rhetorically. What's your answer to that? Why do we do this?
Well, I think there's the philosophical answer, which I think is, you know, innately, I think humans explore, and I think that's what we should be doing. I think the technical reason for why we should do it is all that technology that has to be developed to do something that difficult is used back here on Earth too, and to Earth's benefit. For instance, you know, we're cleaning up urine and all that water on board the space station and recycling it each day, and we're up to around 85% recycling of all our water. In order to go to the moon, we're going to need to be much closer to 100%. But if you develop those technologies that get you to 100%, think what you could do, you know, after hurricanes or, you know, tsunamis where people can't get clean access to clean water. If you could take in a portable system and, you know, clean up the water that's there, you can, you know, save lives in those ways. There's all kinds of technology that gets used all the time. And more we develop, the more it's going to have a benefit. And that'll be here on Earth.
And finally, the last question for you is, of all the experiences you had in space, what's the most fun part of living in space?
You know, the unique thing about being there is the lack of gravity. You don't recognize how your whole life is ruled by gravity here, because your whole life is. And we leave that, learning to adapt in an environment where that rule of everything goes away, is very unique. And it's, and I think one of the most interesting parts of learning to live in space and adapting to the fact that that gravity's not there anymore. So I think just adapting to a completely different environment is probably what I say is the most unique thing about being there.
And Peggy Whitson, you've spent more time in space than just about any other astronaut or cosmonaut. I think you're like eighth all time in time and space. Does a part of you want to go back one more time?
Oh, absolutely. I would go back in a heartbeat. Looking for my ride.
Well, Peggy Whitson, it's been a joy to talk to you, and thank you for your service to not just our country, but the entire world in your exploration of space. And thanks for sharing all your insights with us today.
Well, that's a lot of fun. Great talking to you. You take care. And everybody be well. Stay well.
Thanks once again to our guest, Peggy Whitson. You can follow Peggy on Twitter at AstroPeggy. It's been my pleasure to interview many American astronaut heroes over the years, but I can't think of a single one who was more, pardon my expression, down to earth than this remarkable woman who spent years off of it. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.